Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to JS on Politics, a weekly look at what's happening in Wisconsin and national politics. And we've got a very busy agenda today, and we're going to get right to it. So the presidential picture got a little clearer with New York's results, maybe. We'll look ahead at Tuesday's primaries. We'll also get the latest on the federal investigation into the Lincoln Hills Juvenile Justice Facility and take a look at the story behind the story of the new Common Council president in Milwaukee. We'll also launch our new weekly feature, our Winners and Losers of the Week. And, of course, we'll take some viewer questions, so please send those in. But let's get started with our panel today. We've got Dan Bice, our Watchdog columnist, Mary Spicuzza, one of our political reporters. So let's talk presidential politics. Tuesday was big wins, you know, kind of for the front runners. So it's right. Kind of flipped the script from Wisconsin a week prior or 2 weeks prior. Did anything surprise you about the numbers, the margins? What did you guys think?
I tend to think the presidential election seems very much like an NFL season, where each week it seems like it shifts from one to the other. Like the Packers lose, and everybody thinks the world's over, and Packers win, and then they're talking about the Super Bowl, and you go from Donald Trump loses Wisconsin, everything's terrible, he's got to shuffle his campaign, but then he kills in New York, and actually the margin of victory, I think, was bigger than what we expected, and Cruz's performance was worse than most people thought.
So should we look at it more like a baseball season and a big picture?
What's becoming a baseball season.
Games, you know? What did you think, Mary, of the margin?
Yeah, I was not surprised that Hillary and Trump won, but I was a bit surprised that they won by so big. I don't think that Cruz's New York value slam helped him at all in New York. He obviously is not exactly the candidate you would think of when you would think of who would New Yorkers back. So I think all of those things helped him do worse than he could have.
I said repeatedly that Cruz is not a great fit for Wisconsin, but he's obviously in an even worse fit for New York.
To lose New York. But down in South Carolina, when that was his argument down there, that he's one of us in South Carolina,
right? And there was a precinct in which Ben Carson beat him. So you're obviously not connecting if that's happening. But you know, actually, the turnout wasn't particularly good either compared to Wisconsin, where we had record turnout. There, the turnout was terrible.
Yeah. It seemed the narrative did shift a little bit in terms of the coverage on Trump, that it's seeming maybe even more likely he could get the number needed, and that this contested convention is a little less likely, perhaps, given his margin in New York, because Cruz didn't get any delegates,
right? And so, but it does now shift to Pennsylvania, which is coming up on Tuesday, where you've got some quirky rules about delegates. And the New York Times, their tracking of delegates and so forth, suggests that if everything goes as planned, he'll be about 50 delegates short. And it depends on how these 54 delegates in Pennsylvania, who they line up with, because they can choose whichever candidate they want to go with.
Right. Well, let's take a look at that list of the primaries that are upcoming. So Tuesday we've got a little round of Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, very East Coast flavor, Pennsylvania being the biggest, then Indiana stands alone, and then we kind of rapidly go through other states, some only on one side or the other, till it ends June 7th with the big day, California, the big prize, and a lot of other states at stake, including New Jersey. But looking just at Tuesday, do you see any chance, Mary, for either Bernie Sanders or Ted Cruz to break through? Because those are states that would seem to be more in the flavor of New York.
Yeah, I would be surprised if Cruz does really well in Pennsylvania. I guess I've been surprised before, but I don't know that Trump will do as well as he did in New York, but I would be surprised if Cruz really hits it out of the park there.
Trump's been running about 9 or 10 points ahead in Pennsylvania. But I think for Cruz, his focus, even though he's visiting some of these other states, the smaller states next week, I think his focus, again, moves to the Midwest, to Indiana and Nebraska on May 3rd and May 10th, where he'll hope to duplicate what he did here. in those two states.
Yeah, let's talk briefly about some of the other aspects of the campaign there. So Trump, I mean, part of the discussion has been, is he going to become more presidential, you know, drop the lion Ted and crooked Hillary, then so he didn't one day in his victory speech, he didn't use lion Ted, and then he was back to lion Ted. He's going to put out these, you know, policy speeches and use a teleprompter. Does he need to do that, or do you need Trump to be Trump if he's going to keep running?
We had this discussion about how important Wisconsin was. Well, it did seem to be important to his campaign. He shuffled staff. He hired Rick Riley. He hired some other people. And he sat down with the New York Times and gave this much more, I mean, the story says humble, but it's not really humble. It's still Trump. And he still ends the interview by saying, people vote for me because I win, because I always win, and that's what I am, a winner. But he ends it by saying, knock on wood. So I guess that's the kinder, gentler side of it.
That's the hedging, that's the presidential part of Donald Trump.
So, and he actually did knock on wood. Okay. But the funny thing is, I mean, he is still who he is, and that's not going to change. But I think he's going to try to mute it a little bit.
Yeah. What about, we had Scott Walker this week saying, you know, kind of begrudgingly, I guess, you know, yeah, I guess I would endorse Donald Trump if he's the nominee. You know, that certainly wasn't, you know, I mean, he's been a Ted Cruz guy. And
we've both
Trump
been there.
Guy,
we've both been there when we've asked the question, are you going to support Trump if he's the nominee?
Answered it this way, though.
Right. I mean, you were there in May, in March, when he...
He kept saying it's a long way away, still a lot could happen, it's unclear who the nominee is going to be, we'll deal with that closer to the convention. And, you know, he had in that original debate said that he would support the Republican nominee, whoever it is, but had not been able to say, even if that's Trump. And I don't think he's been able to say Trump's name as I will support Donald Trump
as
the nominee.
Yesterday I asked him, he said, I'll support the nominee, and I said, even if it's Trump, and he goes, yeah. And but then again, he still didn't mention him by name, and he said,
"So it's like Voldemort in the Harry Potter books or something."
He shall not be named. Right? Yes.
Well, I mean, you have to remember when Trump came here, he was not a nice guy to Walker, suggesting his reforms weren't reforms, but had done damage to the state. And he also, what did he say? He
sent him packing like a little boy. He was the one who took him out of the race. He made fun of his motorcycle outfits and saying how he was.
So you expect Democrats to say that sort of stuff, but you don't really expect Republicans. And I think Trump tried to pull back a little bit on that afterwards by saying that he might consider him for vice president. I don't think that's real, but I think that was an olive branch. Yeah. Again, the new kinder, gentler
olive branch, which he might then use to swat the governor.
Seemed to surprise the governor as much as any of us.
So. Let's talk really briefly. Paul Ryan. So he's not running for president. We made that clear. Saturday Night Live is spoofing him on it already. So
and he gets Colbert.
But he's in Kenosha tomorrow, right, to talk about poverty and giving a bigger policy kind of speech. What's he up to?
Do you have any guesses? I mean, what is his end game?
You know, it's funny because he does these events. He's talking about poverty and opportunities for people, which seems like a very kind of presidential. He's talking about the American dream. It seems like a very presidential topic to talk about when you're not running for president, but maybe he's just trying to show that he is focused on his work and taking the high road.
I think it's a case of do you watch what he says or do you watch what he does? And he keeps on saying, and he had the big announcement that I don't want to be the nominee, I won't accept it, but yet he's taking this path where he lays out what the conservative agenda should be. He then chides the candidates, Republican candidates, for the tone of the campaign, and now he's developing this agenda and moving forward with it. I mean, what is his end game? I don't think it's very clear.
He's from the Jack Kemp kind of school, too, of wanting taking a different vantage point than some of the others in the party.
But it's a very different role for a House Speaker. House Speakers are usually nuts and bolts guys who are responsible for getting the numbers together. He's instead using the position to create a platform for what he thinks America should be and what the Republicans should be standing for.
All right. Well, we're going to turn out at the state level and go to this tape segment here for an update on the Lincoln Hill situation. We're joined now by Jason Stein, one of our Madison Bureau reporters, to give us an update on the situation at Lincoln Hills. This, of course, is the Juvenile Justice Center in northern Wisconsin that's under federal examination right now. The latest headlines have been about shortages of staffing and other issues. Can you give us the latest, Jason?
Sure. We've had some updates in recent days where we talk about chronic staffing shortages at Lincoln Hills School for Boys and Copper Lake School for Girls. And the way the state has tried to cope with that is by sending up corrections workers from other state facilities. Now, these may be folks who may not be trained in dealing with the unique challenges of juvenile inmates, but they've been paying to have them fed and housed in hotel rooms up in northern Wisconsin. And now they're also trying to bring in new recruits as well. But obviously, turnover issues and just vacancies are a challenge across the prison system. So that's something that's not just an issue in Lincoln Hills or even just in state-run institutions, as we'll talk about in a second.
Yeah. So the one of the other headlines this week was from the that the John Doe, the state-level probe into the problems there, had closed. Is there any real significance there in terms of a practical matter, or is this more of a political interest given the other changes in the John Doe law last year?
I think time will tell on that, Greg. Obviously, the federal authorities continue to have two probes or two investigations going on Lincoln Hills. The first is a criminal investigation, and the other one is a pattern and practices review looking at whether the civil rights of the inmates at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake schools were systematically violated. So there's still clearly very serious reviews happening at Lincoln Hills, even with the state criminal probe shut down. But there could still be significance from that, because obviously the state has the ability to charge certain crimes that the federal government may not. So that's still something we'll have to watch and remember.
All right, let's talk about that. The federal probe, as you noted, it's going on in sort of two tracks. So what is there any timetable on this, or an end game that can be seen in terms of ultimately federal oversight, or where do you think this thing is headed?
Well, there's absolutely a timetable, and there's absolutely an end game. And if I knew what they were, I would tell them to you. But I think what we have to remember is that this is a massive investigation that has involved at least dozens of state and federal agents, hundreds of interviews, hundreds of people that have to be looked at either as victims or perpetrators potentially. So this is obviously going to take them some time. The state attorney general gave the figure of a year several months ago. Who knows if that's accurate or not, given, the stage that it was at that time. I think, though, one thing that the state of Wisconsin, both taxpayers and public officials will have to be very vigilant about is the possibility that the federal government could impose some kind of sanctions or consent decree on the state to make it change its practices in terms of how it handles juvenile inmates, and that obviously could carry a price tag.
All right, let me ask you finally on the, what happens in the meantime, because there's not a lot of other options for local, the county level to send youth. Milwaukee's running into its own issues here. What sort of issues is this causing in the interim?
Well, that's a good question, Greg. Obviously, in the long run, I think there are other models that from other states and simply from other county level officials like Racine County, La Crosse County, that policymakers, elected officials can look to. But here's the problem. In the short term, it's very hard to build up bandwidth or new capacity at a secure detention facility. And that's what we're seeing in Milwaukee. Milwaukee County's secure detention facility potentially already had some challenges with staffing and other problems. And as Milwaukee County judges and officials became very reluctant to send new inmates to Lincoln Hills because of the problems there, the challenges at Milwaukee County's detention facility also got worse. And so now we're seeing, similar problems of staff turnover, the potential for violence or safety problems, even if that hasn't yet played out at that facility that was reported on in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel this week. So, you know, this is something that's obviously going to take state and local officials a long time to work through.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for that update. And, you know, thanks for joining us today, Jason.
Thank you, Greg.
All right, we're back live, and let's talk a little bit, Dan and Mary, about, you know, Lincoln Hills and what potential fallout there is on this, especially on the political level, because it doesn't reflect well on the governor and his administration and a whole host of people. What, and are you,
yesterday,
the governor talked about it.
Yeah, yesterday I asked him about the Lincoln Hills situation. I was asking him specifically about the John Doe law, because the John Doe investigation at Lincoln Hills ended because this new time limit that had been set up with the John Doe reform says that an investigation can only go 6 months, and if you want to extend it beyond 6 months, you have to get 10 judges to sign off on it. He defended the changes in the John Doe law and says that it's his understanding that the Attorney General finished everything that he wanted to do, which is probably true since you've got the feds running around who have more power and can convene a grand jury or whatever. But so he's defending the administration on that front. But obviously, this is not a good thing for his administration. It's all happened on his watch.
Yeah, this may take some time to play out, many more months, potentially, the investigation. But are there how do you think the governor has responded so far in terms of any steps he has taken to, you know, get things cleaned up there?
You know, he said that he was very proactive and responded very quickly when he first learned about the problems. And he also tried to say that there was a few bad apples and not a huge widespread thing. Records have shown that they were actually, his office was alerted far before he had, we'd initially been led to believe, and it does sound like it was more widespread than we originally thought. So I think neither of those things bode well for him, and I guess we'll just have to see how widespread, how serious, and how many red flags were there along the way.
It'll be interesting because you have this investigation, which is probably going to take a while because it's pretty large and massive, and it'll probably show how much people knew about this at the same time that Walker is going around the state and implying very heavily, very strongly that he's going to run for re-election. And no one knows if that's true or not because he obviously doesn't want to become a lame duck, but that is the message that they were hoping to get out when going around the state yesterday.
All right. Well, let's shift now to local elections and the Milwaukee Common Council, where, as we sort of anticipated on this show, there was a showdown. I mean, the 15-0 vote, notwithstanding, for Common Council President. Alderman Ashanta Hamilton is in the position now. Mary, tell us a little bit about him and how he may differ from Michael Murphy, who was there before.
Right. So late last week, Alderman Murphy was saying he had the votes. Obviously, a couple of people changed their minds, one or two, and flipped to support Hamilton, who's been on the council for a while, obviously not as long as Murphy, who's the longest-serving member. He's becoming the fourth African-American president. He's talked about wanting to eradicate poverty, talked about wanting to fight crime and create more job opportunities, especially in the neighborhoods and the inner cities in Milwaukee. So I think we'll just have to see. He didn't really have specifics on what he would do in his first, 100 days as president or specific platform, but he said that he thought that he was picked because he could bridge this divide between North and South. And you saw it was a pretty interesting group of people supporting him.
Yeah, well, how did that come about? I mean, because it'd be very rare to see, Bob Donovan and some of the South Side guys, voting with the North Side.
Yeah. Well, before we get to that, just on Ashanti a little bit more, when he came into the council, he was plagued by a number of problems, personal and financial problems, and that led up eventually to the biggest one where he was charged with a felony for abusing his daughter. He had a deferred prosecution agreement. He pleaded no contest, and the charge has been wiped off the books since then. But his mother had problems. He had family problems. Financial problems, home was foreclosed on. But it looks like, since 2011, he's cleaned up much of that. Still had a financial problem in 2013. But it'll be interesting to see if he can fix all of those problems behind the scenes as the leader. But in terms of thinking about the council, I think of it as you have the Black Caucus, then you have the South Side Conservatives, which you're making mention of, and then you have the downtown East Side and West Side liberals who are affiliated with Barrett, and they're the ones who've controlled the council over the last 2 years. And the South Side conservatives ended up aligning with the Black Caucus to get the votes to put Ashanti into power. The question is, how long will this alliance remain?
Yeah, but how did it happen? Those things don't just happen by accident, right? I mean, is there some deals that were cut, or how does it, you know, turn out?
Yeah, so President Hamilton, as he was speaking on the floor, thanked Tony Zelensky for taking the lead to bring these different coalitions together.
And Tony's with the Southside Conservatives.
Right, and he was obviously a longtime politician. He was on the board, the county board, now he's on the city. So he was really singled out as kind of somebody behind the scenes making all of this happen. Obviously, there's been talk of Craig Peterson, who has been involved and increasingly involved in city politics as being interested in seeing a new leader who is not Michael Murphy. I think a lot of people felt like Michael Murphy works very, very closely with the mayor, which is not necessarily a bad thing unless you don't like what the mayor's doing or think he has too much power.
But there was concern.
He was one of your losers after the election, right? And is he now?
He does emerge as, I mean, he doesn't have a lot of, he doesn't have the majority of candidates. Most of his candidates who were first-time candidates lost. But there was, I mean, what seems to be the trigger is that some of the liberals, and in particular Kovac, helped support candidates against those South Side candidates, and the South Side candidates emerged. It was close, like in Donovan's case, where he just barely beat Justin Belinsky, but he wins. And so those individuals were eager to cut an alliance with the Black Caucus to take control and to move the right. Murphy team
and
out.
Kovac, he's seen as real close to Murphy, right?
Right.
He's Murphy's choice as finance committee chairman.
Right, which he probably will not be when they announce the committee assignments.
Guess not.
Yeah. Right.
But
so
you could maybe imagine Tony Zelensky in that role because
possibly,
that'd be a good, reward.
I mean, you do. The big question is, how long does this alliance remain in place? Because the priorities and perspectives of the Black Caucus and the South Side conservatives are very different. Both are focused on crime, but like Bob Donovan every year wants to hire 200 more cops.
It's a completely different perspective on how they want to tackle crime.
Right. How they want to tackle crime and what happens.
Or reactions to officer-involved shootings are going to obviously be very different, so it'll be interesting to see how long this alliance lasts.
Okay. You wrote this week, Dan, about two of the aldermen, I guess former alderman Alan Joe Davis, who didn't, seek re-election. Where did they go after the mayor's race? And,
I don't know. I mean, no one likes a loser, and no one likes a sore loser, but after Joe Davis finished a disappointing third in February in the mayoral primary, he pretty much disappeared. He attended a total of 3 meetings from that point on. He had 19 that he was supposed to go to. He made it to 3, and you have to remember he's being paid $75,000 a year. But he didn't respond to anything. I know he went to South Africa for a week or two. He visited South Africa on the city's dime a couple of times. And I know his wife is from there, but he didn't explain why he was there, why he missed the meetings, and his excuses to the Common Council just simply said, I'm going to be gone. Bob Donovan, who finished second and eventually loses to Mayor Barrett in the mayoral contest, also made it to just about half his meetings since the primary. And he says part of that was that he had a lot of stuff to do running for mayor, running for re-election to the council, and that he had some personal issues that he was dealing with.
All right. Well, let's turn now to a new segment we're introducing today because we had so much fun when we did winners and losers from the elections at the end of the year. So we thought, let's do this.
And I do them every time.
Every election. So we're going to start with Dan. Who is your winner of the week?
Of the week, I'd say Paul Ryan. Paul has announced he's gotten more publicity for saying he's not running for an office than just about anybody. He's probably getting more publicity by saying he doesn't want to be president than Scott Walker got by saying he did want to be president.
All right, that's a good strategic move there.
I mean, he ends up on Colbert, ends up on Saturday Night Live, and he's given this major speech tomorrow.
How did he do on Colbert? Because that's always a test when you can you be glib enough and,
it's a little tough, but it was scripted, obviously, and it looked like he was reading some of the lines at the very end, but it was good, fun, and, if you're playing along with Colbert, it should turn out okay.
Yeah. All right, and Mary, who is your winner of the week?
I would say, I have a couple. There's birthday boy Dan Bice, and then I would also say Ashanti Hamilton, who obviously came out the president of the Common Council.
So which one's higher?
We have to choose who's the winner.
I'll leave that up to you.
There's winners and there's winners, right? Okay, so and who is your loser of the week?
I would say my loser would be Michael Murphy, who obviously did not come out very well in the president race. We'll see what committees he gets. He was a gracious loser, I would say, so I think that will serve him well.
Right, so he released his support, right?
Or
he
didn't, quickly
he
released,
just dropped himself from the...
Right.
But he was
even,
just on Friday saying he had the votes.
Right.
So this happened pretty quickly. He thought he had enough people to be reelected on Tuesday, but it just, he lost that support. So where's that put Mayor Barrett? He sort of is in the middle there.
He's, he did not endorse in the president's race. He said that he has worked closely with Murphy. He said he's worked closely with Hamilton. I think he and Murphy have worked well together for the last 2 years, and I think anyone would probably want to go with somebody that they know who has worked well with them and worked closely with them on issues. But he said he's praised Hamilton and said they worked closely together, too, and tried to not affiliate too closely with one or the other.
So my loser of the week is someone we haven't talked about in a long time, Bill Cramer, former Assembly Majority Leader, who last we heard he was being sentenced for two Class A misdemeanors for sexual offenses. I've been told by several people that he was and has been checking into running for re-election, only to find out that he can't because he will still be on probation at the time of the election. But I don't think it's very clear to Bill that he left office in disgrace.
All right. And, of course, that's after a certain age of birthdays, which would generally put you in the loser category. But Dan's not
what
there
is that?
Yet. He's
after,
still in the winner category. I don't know where the threshold is.
You're
not there yet.
I was going to say, if it's 50, I'm in trouble.
That's probably 50. All right. Let's turn now to our viewer questions. I'm going to go the first one to Dan. This is from reader or viewer named Dubs, who says, "Is Tom Barrett the least scrutinized public figure in the history of Milwaukee politics?"
I've written a fair bit of critical things of Mayor Barrett, but the fact is, he's had three races in a row now where he didn't have much of an opponent. And some of the criticism emerges and comes out during an election. Clearly, like Chris Abele had a very tough race and came under a lot of scrutiny during that time. So I've said this before, Mayor Barrett is an incredibly cautious office holder. There's strengths and weaknesses with that. The strength is he emphasizes he doesn't make a lot of mistakes. The weakness is that he doesn't really push forward a very aggressive agenda. And he seems timid at times.
Sometimes that scrutiny comes when you do bold or brash kind of things, right? Or real dramatic things. He would never have done Act 10.
Right. I mean, he's not the sort of guy to do that. And as I told him when interviewing him on the show, if it's fourth and one at the 50-yard line, he's going to punt. Maybe on third down, he'd punt. I mean, he's just that cautious.
I would say that also scrutiny comes from having a very tough opponent, a very close race, a well-funded opponent, attack ads going against you, and he did not have that this time
around. We thought maybe Donovan would, but Donovan was imploding the entire 2 months, so that just didn't happen.
Yeah.
All right, so this is a question I'll throw to Mary from Jimmy, and the question is, so what happens to Alderman Murphy now? Can you say Utilities and Licenses Committee? And, of course, that's not the most popular one.
As someone who covered
many of those meetings, and they last a
long time. That could go to Kovac. I don't know.
But what do you think he's going to do?
You know,
he's the veteran senior person on the council.
He is. I don't think that he will have the worst committee assignments that could go to Kovac.
I don't think people dislike Murphy.
No, I don't think
so. Like they dislike Kovac.
I think that that is true. I think that there are people who probably felt like Kovac had too much power and wanted to see him taken down a few notches, and I would not be surprised if he does not get the plushest office, the plushest committee assignment. I think Murphy, he's the longest serving member. He's been there since 89. I don't know that he's burned that many bridges. We'll just have to see. He didn't put his name in the race and make people vote against Hamilton. They had 15-0 unanimous vote. I think all of that spoke well for him kind of graciously exiting.
I am wondering about Ashanti just in terms of his tendency. He's considered a smart guy, hardworking guy, but not much of a visionary so far. Is he setting this up to eventually run against Barrett? I mean, we just talked about that. Does he try to come up with his own platform? Is he confrontational with the mayor, or is he cooperative with the mayor? I mean, those are the things to watch for, in addition to the question about how long this alliance holds.
All right, and lastly, this was a question from Money Man, who says, and I'll ask this for both of you, was Harriet Tubman your pick for the $20 bill?
I have no idea, but you know, one person who's not going to get on any dollar bill is Ben Carson after his little snide remark that she deserved to go on the $2 bill.
I don't think he was really threatening for.
I think he came under.
Doing, Harriet Tubman.
I don't know that I picked her. I mean, I think that after hearing that, it was like, oh, yeah, why didn't I think of that? But I don't know that I spent that much time thinking about who would go on the bill.
All right, maybe it's time that we don't have
need
enough
to refocus.
$20 bills in our wallets.
I haven't seen one in so long.
Right? So, all right, well, that's where we'll leave our show for today. We'll be back next week at the same time and the same computer, so tune in next week.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.